button. We have Karen Linusville talking about email authentication now.
Okay. I'm not sure where I'm going to stand. Down here, I think. So my name is Karen Linusville. I'm going to talk about email authentication, and I want to give you my opinion whether you should use it and tell you a little bit about how it works. First of all, a little bit about me. I'm K7, for those who are on IRC, or Karen Linusville. I'm a systems admin. You can see me in my natural habitat in there, which is in a data center, installing new hardware or repairing some stuff. And I currently work as an infrastructure manager at Touchpoint, which is a New Zealand company who works in interactive marketing, digital marketing. We developed a platform that allows our clients to do email, text, websites, and all kinds of promotions on one single platform. And as part of my daily work, I am responsible for delivering the emails that we send, and we do send a lot of emails. This is also the reason why I'm giving this talk, mainly from the point of view how you send as a sender of emails. It's not done from the point of view how you filter spam, more how you get those emails into the inbox. But anyway, whatever I'm going to tell you will help you with filtering spam as well, because you use the same methodology. So what am I going to talk about? I want to give you a little bit about the definition, what email authentication is from my point of view, and what methods are used. There are several out there that are actually being used currently, and who uses it? Is it actually used in real life? I want to tell you a little bit about the problems and advantages. Does it actually work? And my opinion about it. A tiny little bit about how to implement it. Just some pointers where you can start looking if you want to do it yourself. And where to go from here, should you use it and should you actually look into it. So first of all, the definition. What is email authentication? Email authentication is verifying the sender of an email. So you want to know whether the person who says he sent this email is actually the person who sends the email. Generally, the idea is about security improvements. So I want to make it more difficult to send emails with forged sender addresses. The second goal was to reduce spam, so help with spam filtering, filter all those out who send with forged or fake email addresses. So the verification of an email sender is one step to avoid phishing and spam, and it's important to have some methods around it because the SMTP protocol was not really designed with security in mind, so it's really easy to forge an email address or to forge a whole email. The basic idea behind all those different email authentication methods is to use DNS. The reason for this is that if you as a domain owner have access to the DNS, you are the one who can authenticate the different senders or servers who send your email. So this is the assumption. This assumes that the DNS is secure. If you verify the sender, you can either look at the envelope, which is part of the SMTP protocol, or you can look at the front headers of the email content. But you just verify the sender. It's important to say this is not a method to check any content. It's just about the sender. It doesn't say anything about whether I have a malicious intent to send you. It just says that I am what I tell you that I am. So what are the different methods that are out there currently? There's two different sets of methods that are available. They're all DNS-based, as I've already said, and they have been around for a while now, starting with SPF, which was available since 2000. So the first two methods, SPF Sender Policy Framework and Sender ID, are both IP address-based. So they just authorize IP addresses of email senders. So there's nothing but a list of IP addresses that you publish, and say, these are the servers that I sent mail from. And the second pair, domain key and DKIM, are cryptographic methods. So they involve signing the messages, part of the messages, and with keys. So there's public and private key pairs involved and things like that. So a little bit more about the first two ones. SPF has the basic idea that you publish a list of mail sending server IP addresses as a DNS text record. And this is how it looks like. So you say, this text record is actually for SPF, and this is my server list of addresses that I send. So my MX server sends, and another server sends, and I'm not really sure whether this is all, but it could be. I can make this into a minus all, and then I say, this is all, everything, and nothing else should be authenticated to send for me. So if a mail server that is not in this list of defined SPF records sends an email, then this message will fail SPF verification. So the receiving sender, if it checks for SPF records, will say, oh, no, you're not on that list, so you're kind of dodgy. It'll most likely not reject the message, but just give it some additional spam points and might end up in the junk mail folder. The whole message checks the envelope only, so just the SMTP part of the whole mail sending process, not what you see in your email client. And the second problem that I see with this is, and it has been voiced very often, it can break email forwarding. Because if you forward an email, instead of remailing it from your mail client, you just forward it from your server without rewriting anything in the headers or in the envelope, it'll look like this message was originating from you, but your server is not in this list, so your message will fail SPF checks. This will happen if you have a mailing list server or something like that that forwards email messages. So it's one of the big problems with SPF. There's ways around this. There's whitelists, SRS, and all kinds of things to rewrite the headers. So you can make this work, and a lot of people do. The second IP-based method was developed by Microsoft, who came along and said, oh, we can do this better. They had a new idea, said, well, we're just going to do the caller ID for email, and then they went along and patented the whole thing. And what they do is they thought, okay, we can't just look at the envelope. We have to look at the content as well. And they came up with a PRA, the purported responsible address concept. So basically, they just guess from all the content that the whole message has in the envelope who is actually the responsible sender, and then they check against this responsible sender. Most of the time, it works quite well, but sometimes they just guess the wrong way. But it's a similar concept as the SPF1. It looks quite similar as the SPF1 or a sender ID text record. So you just publish a text record in a DNS with a list of the IP addresses of your mail servers. You can use include records, so you can include SPF records or sender ID records from other servers. It works for both SPF and sender ID. The problem with this is not only that it's patented by Microsoft and not compatible with GPL, it also violates other standards or is incompatible with existing email standards because it requires header rewriting for you to be able to forward messages. And that's kind of the holy grail of sending emails. You don't rewrite headers. You just add your own ones. Okay. So on to the cryptographic methods that came on a little bit later. So Yahoo as an ISP and receiving a lot of emails had a better idea, they thought, and came up with the whole concept of domain keys and just, again, patented and said, this is what we do to authenticate the sender of an email. both methods, DKIM and domain key, are quite similar. And when it came to RFC publishing, the whole domain key concept was actually just published as a historic standard. It's not something that you should use. It's just, that was there before DKIM came along. DKIM is actually a merging of a standard from Yahoo and the domain key concept and the Cisco concept, identified mail. so IM, so this is HUB. And this was actually published as an RFC as well, and it's supposed to be compatible with domain keys. These, both of them, DKIM, is still very much in flux. The last standard that was published, the last RFC, was from August, so there's still a lot of discussion around it, how to do it exactly, but it's still used widely. The whole method works that you, as an email sender, you sign the message and the headers with a key that is published via DNS so that the recipient can validate the signature and find out two things. The first thing is you as a sender has access to the private key, so you must be a valid sender. And the second thing is the content of that message, if the whole message was signed, wasn't changed. It's quite a good thing as well. So you not only verify the sender, but also the content of the message. To be able to do that, you need to publish two different DNS records, the first one being underscore domain key, and the second one being key dot underscore domain key. This can be anything. I can come back to it in a minute. And then you can start using it. So it's, again, it's just text record in the DNS that you have to publish, and then you can start using it. A little bit more about how it works in detail. So as a sender, you sign the email content and some of the headers. You add a header with the to the email message, and this header contains the signature and the encrypted hash of the message. It contains the domain you're signing it for and the name of the key, which is this record, basically. And then the recipient uses that header to find out where to get the public key from, to decrypt the hash, generate its own hash, and compare those two hashes, and if they match, the message hasn't been changed. In this case, you're not looking at the envelope, you're looking at the header itself or the from domain of the message, so you don't really care what the envelope says, you just use the from header or what is in the header itself. So what are the differences between DKIM and domain key? DKIM enhanced the whole domain key concept because they had a while to look at the whole concept and found some weaknesses. And the first thing that they did was DKIM self-signs the header that you put in that contains all the information just to make sure that this header hasn't been changed, because if you can change that header, then the whole process doesn't really work anymore. The second thing is you can allow a third party to sign those messages, so that makes forwarding work, and you can take responsibilities for messages that you signed that come from other people. Or you can give other people your key, and they send messages for you and sign with your key. So that's what we do, what Touchpoint does. And the second thing is, if you use DKIM, you have to list the headers that you sign so that it's clear which part of the message is actually signed or which part of the headers is signed and which is not signed, just to make it more secure. So if you want to know if an email is signed, you can look at the headers. This is how headers for emails look like that have been signed. The first one is in DKIM signature, so you have basically, this is the domain, this is the name of the key, this is the headers that are assigned by the message, this is the an identifier, and this is the hash of the header, and this is the hash of the whole message. The domain key is a little bit shorter because it doesn't contain the hash of the header, but they are quite similar. So I already said domain key is patented by Yahoo, so it's not really open source. But DKIM is licensed by GPL. Problem is, Yahoo is sometimes threatening to say, but this is half of our patent, so we might not allow you to license this under GPL 2. So we'll see how that works out. Both those methods have some technical problems, which I'll tell you about in a minute. So who uses it? A lot. It's actually quite used a lot. So senders use it to authenticate their servers and their messages. People who send bulk email messages or a lot of messages use it. It's also used by ISPs to verify incoming messages and fight the whole spam wave that's coming at them. They also partially sign emails themselves or publish SPF or sender ID records. So Yahoo or Extra, who uses Yahoo to send emails in New Zealand, they check for domain key or DKIM, but they don't sign anything. Google or Gmail signs with DKIM, and they verify DKIM and SPF records. And for one thing, if you have a person in your contact list at Gmail and they use DKIM, the images will show up by default. So because it's a trusted source, which is what you want if you're us and you send emails. You want people to see the whole message, not just without the images. Hotmail checks for SPF and DKIM, but does not sign anything. So Microsoft invented the whole sender ID standard, but they don't even publish any sender ID DNS. They just publish SPF. It's kind of interesting, I think. AOL verifies DKIM, but doesn't sign it. So there's actually quite used, and there's a lot of email being already sent or verified. SpamAssassin can, for instance, verify domain keys, DKIM, or SPF records if you allow it to. So how does it look like as a recipient? It's quite hard to see if you don't look at the headers. And none of the existing email clients, desktop email clients, does actually show anything. But Yahoo has started an interesting thing in their webmail client. They started to show this little key in front of a message that has been identified with a DKIM. So if you use Yahoo webmail client, you can see this little key. And Gmail just invented the super trustworthy anti-phishing key, which they only allow to be used for eBay and PayPal currently. So PayPal and eBay both sign their messages with DKIM and can be verified by Gmail as authenticated. And so they show this little key as well. And Gmail has promised to open up to everybody who is going to sign their messages with DKIM in the future. They're just running a test currently, and so you'll see this key a little bit more often. Hotmail doesn't do anything, so you won't see any difference at all, but you won't see any difference in Thunderbird, Evolution, or anywhere. So you have to look at the headers. Problems. So the use of non-free technology makes it obviously problematic to integrate the whole thing into the distributions and make it available via easy package install. So there's nothing like upget install DKIM, and then you're gone. So there's a little bit more tricksy stuff to do. The second problem that I see, it breaks some usage cases. So we have to still do some work to actually make it easier to use for different email installations, like mail server, mailing lists, and things like that. Some of the methods break RFCs, which is not a good thing to do from my point of view. And we also have some technical problems. Some of them are, when I try to set up an instance that does that and signs my email messages with the whole domain key in DKIM, I ran into problems with my DNS provider because they don't allow records with underscores. There's not a lot of web interfaces out there for DNS providers that can actually manage underscores or, even worse, semicolons in DNS records. They are valid records for DNS and text entries, but most of them can't. So this is one of the problems. If you want to use it, you have to check it. The next problem is domain key sizes. So you have a maximum length of DNS entries for all text entries of 512 bytes. And you might run into trouble if you have several records as TXT records in your DNS, that you have an overall length that is bigger than 512 bytes. So you have to use shorter keys. And the problem with shorter keys is they're easier crackable. So we have to check how many records you actually create for a domain and that you don't use it to for kind of silly comments, that some people do. And rather use it for domain keys and SPF records or sender ID records. Same is valid for SPF records. You have to keep your SPF records less than 450 characters. So if you have lots and lots of mail servers, then you have to work with include statements to make it work. Advantages. Reduce spam. It actually does work. It reduces spam because you can sort out all the ones that work with forged addresses. You can't sort out the ones that work with their own domains and sign them. But you can sort out the ones that try to send as Gmail and they aren't really Gmail because Gmail signs their messages. The second advantage that I see is it's the first step to add security between sender and recipient. So get the whole trust working again and start working at the relationship between sender and recipient so that they believe each other who they are and it goes away. It goes from an untrusted communications way to a more trusted communications way. How to? Just a little bit about how to. So as I told you, SPF and sender ID is DNS, so it's easy. You should do it. It's not... Yeah, especially... it's just easy. Domain keys in DKIM is a little bit more complicated because you have to check with your DNS provider first whether you allow underscores. There's no problem in bind. You can, if you can edit your zone records, you can just do it. But if you have to go through a web interface, you might break stuff. If they don't escape it properly, you might break stuff at their end heavily. And you also need libraries with special licenses. So depending on your project, you might have trouble getting those through. So XM 4.7 has native support for DKIM. Yay. Problem is, it's not unstable yet. So you need to install it from backports, and then you can do it. Or you have to compile it against libdkim to be able to do libdkim. If you want to use domain keys, and in some cases it actually makes sense because some software still only checks against domain keys. So if you want to be double sure, you do domain keys as well. You have to compile against a library that isn't really actively maintained anymore, so not a good idea. If you want to do both, you can use DKIM proxy, which is basically a proxy that runs in parallel to your mail server, takes the message, signs it, passes it back on to your MTA, and then it goes out. Same with postfix. You install DKIM and filter or DK filter, then you, or DKIM proxy if you want to do both. You generate the keys, you set up your DNS, and you configure postfix to use it, and then you can start signing your messages. So, my opinion, whether you should. Generally, if you send emails professionally and you have problems with deliverability, yes, you should try if you have an improvement with email authentication. It becomes a requirement if you have more than your MX server sending emails. So your MX server is the one that you use in your DNS to receive all the messages. But a lot of people and a lot of projects have more than this server sending emails, and they don't want them to come back there. You just want them to go out there, web servers, application servers, and things like that. So then you have to have some form of authentication because most likely in all cases with Hotmail, Gmail, Yahoo, you won't get through. You have to have at least an SPF record. If you send large amount of emails, like several thousand per day, then you have to have it as well. If you want to sign up for feedback loops, you have to have some form of authentication. A feedback loop is if a user in a webmail client at Yahoo or Gmail or Hotmail clicks on the report this as spam button, those ISPs actually forward the message to the sender to give the feedback and say these messages are not really seen as valid messages by the recipients. Please consider your content or take these guys off your sending lists. This is a feedback loop. If you want to sign up for reputation services like ReturnPath or Goodmail, you have to have email authentication. Reputation services are basically commercial whitelists, so you have to go through a certification process, and then they tell you that you are one of the good guys, that you only send good messages. Then you get a stamp, and those ISPs will whitelist you. And to make that whole process work, you have to have email authentication, otherwise you can't prove that you are actually yourself sending. Okay, it's nice to have if you have concerns about phishing from your domain. So then domain key might help. Problem is the recipient can't actually see if they don't look at the headers that use it. So if you, your email client doesn't show it, then it's just on your end that you can work on something against phishing. It's also good to have if you have problems getting your email through, just try SPF. It might increase your recipient rate very much. And it's also nice to help with your spam filtering. So if you set up your spam filtering software to check for SPF records and just give it a little bit additional points for each record that fails, then it might help you with not receiving that much spam. Do I see any alternatives? Not totally sure that this is the best way to go forward because a lot of things kind of hang on patented or not patented issues. So I'd rather see some open source method that everybody can integrate in their distributions. And one of the ways forward might be DNSSEC is out there. There's a lot of discussion around it, what we can use DNSSEC once it has been established for as well. It's a whole, it allows you to the whole public key infrastructure to use, so you can use it to distribute the public keys, or you can just use it to make DNS more secure so that you can authenticate your email messages with your DNS, and your DNS is signed with DNSSEC, so it is clear that this is your DNS and not someone's poison cache or whatever. And one of the other ideas that works on top of it is .TLS, which is encrypted email, which works with certificate. And if you use certificates, they're not self-signed, but authenticate yourself or your mail server so that this can work as a trusted infrastructure for email authentication as well. Okay. Questions? None. Good. Yeah, the UDP package is supposed to be only 512 bytes, if I'm correct. And you can have, the way DNS works, it can't check for one specific TXT record, it gets all of them. And if all of them are bigger than 512 bytes, because you have a very long SPF record that's longer than 400 characters, and you add some keys to it, then it gets bigger, and then it gets fragmented. And then you can't get your key size that has to be at least 1025 bits. Can't get that one into the whole text record. Yes, which is not a good thing. No. And you don't want fragmented UDP packets, don't you? Yes. So then you have half the key, and that whole breaks the whole thing. Couple of links. They'll be on the slides. And these were not my own photos. There was someone else's photos.